I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Between 25 and 30% of students report being bullied. So as a new school year gets underway, how are educators confronting this harmful behavior? Today we learn how the Kansas Department of Education is tackling the problem. It's turning to administrators, teachers, staff, and students for possible solutions. We'll ask if a state-appointed task force can find a better way to stop bullies. Then, women have long been underrepresented on the opinion and editorial pages of newspapers, magazines, and journals. Two who made their way successfully offer thoughts on how women and men can find their voices and be heard. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas is still struggling to get a handle on school bullying, even though the state has had an anti-bullying law for more than a decade. One problem appears to be the near constant use of smartphones, and social media sure doesn't help. So the state has put together a panel of teachers, counselors, and others to put together recommendations that will go to the State Board of Education this winter. Exactly where the panel is headed remains unclear, but given the severity of the problem, we thought it might be a good time for an update. With us is Rick Ginsburg. He's the co-chair of the Kansas Department of Education's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Bullying. Rick is also dean of the University of Kansas Department of Education, and he joins us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio this morning. Rick, it's nice to have you. Welcome to the show.
Steve, thanks for having me.
What do the latest numbers show, Rick? How big a problem do we have when it comes to bullying in Kansas?
Yeah, it's hard to come down with specific numbers, so I'll give you kind of the broad numbers that we have, and it, you know, depends on what kind of bullying you're looking at. You're looking at cyberbullying, you're looking at the more traditional kind of bullying that existed, but it's at the lowest ebb at the elementary level, it's at the highest ebb at the middle school level, and a little bit lower at the high school level, but it's generally running in the middle school range up as high as we get reports of about 25%. At the high school level, maybe 17 to 18% of the kids report some kind of bullying. Now, again, this is self-report, and there's not a necessarily a clear definition in people's minds when we are surveys are done. And we haven't collected those data. Those are data that were collected by the State Department. But those data kind of reflect what you would find nationally in the various surveys that we see.
Do you have any sense, even broadly speaking, if the problem is improving? Is it getting better, or is it getting worse?
I have in my gut what I think. I don't have any data on that. I do think that, as you led us in with the issue about what we call cyberbullying,
right?
I think that has certainly exacerbated the problem, and what makes it really difficult for educators is that this, most times, I think, many times anyway, is happening off the school grounds, yet it follows the students into the schoolhouse gate, and that we educators have to deal with what's happening in the evening at home, over the weekends, but is affecting students in classrooms. And so I, you know, just because of that, and, you know, it, now it's even worse. I mean, kids use things like, you know, you're old if you use Facebook now. You know, kids use things like Snapchat that go away in either 60 seconds or 24 hours. And so how do you trace that and how do you follow that? I suppose at some point in time there will be technological software and things like that that can trace these things. But right now I don't think anybody has the financial wherewithal to follow all the kids all the time.
I was going to say, this notion of this happening digitally, doesn't that make dealing with this problem next to impossible for a teacher, you know, unless the kid getting bullied shows a parent or a teacher his phone?
I wouldn't use the word impossible, but I certainly it makes it more difficult. Look, it was difficult enough in my day before all the electronic stuff for educators to really know what the kids were doing through one another. And It's, as you point out, it's obviously much harder when people have their private machines. You know, it's a strange thing. I mean, I don't, I'm not a fan. This is me personally. This is not the, the task force of any kind of zero tolerance policy about electronic media, electronic devices. I mean, it's amazing that an iPhone is more powerful than all the computers that NASA had when they put put somebody on the moon.
Right, right.
Why would you not want that in the classroom? Yet with that comes all the very things that you're talking about. So how you do it, let's just say it makes it much, much more complicated to deal with.
I was going to say, and the other thing that complicates things is, if I understand the dynamic correctly, kids don't typically, you know, fess up that they're having a problem. It's, that's sort of going against the code, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some evidence of that. I don't think that's just because of technology. I think that's been true historically with kids. I mean, did you tell your mom and dad everything? I don't think so.
Yeah, right, right.
And then to play that out to your teacher or whoever else it might be. So that certainly is a part of it. You know, in this world, we talk about the victims, and then many times victims become perpetrators themselves. You obviously have perpetrators. And then you have what are either called bystanders or witnesses. And those are the, all of us that somehow know this is going on, whether face-to-face or in some kind of electronic social media venue, that just don't do anything about it. And you know, what we need to do is engage the whole community, that's the kids and their families and everybody, in that realizing that this is difficult and trying to address it. So I don't – that's why I say I don't think it's impossible, but it is – complex, especially in an environment, in a sense, that's somewhat toxic, both on the left and the right, I think, in terms of how people deport themselves, whether it be on Twitter or any other space right now. Just imagine how difficult that makes it for teachers.
Well, why is the state looking at this problem again now, Rick?
Well, I think they're looking at it because that there's this recognition that this is a problem that has festered for a long time, and with the best efforts, I mean, Kansas passed the law. It's a pretty good law. I mean, they tried to, they required that everybody have a plan. They proposed a some kind of definition. And yet, certainly the problem hasn't gone away. And as you suggest, although I don't have before and after data that I can tell you it's gotten worse, it certainly hasn't gone away. I don't think it's gone down. And so the state board has said that we need to take this on, and we need to do what we can to help educators. A part of it is there is some evidence that what is called now socio-emotional learning can have some impact on school culture, which I think is the big issue, and in a positive way. And, this board and its commissioner program we call Kansas Can has socio-emotional learning and training as a vital part of what we're trying to do. So I think the state says this can be a part of that. Let's team on that, and let's move forward in trying to be as proactive as we can and trying to address a problem that we all agree is real and rather complicated.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about bullying in Kansas schools and what the state and what teachers can do about it. If you want to join our conversation, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm visiting with Rick Ginsburg. He's the co-chair of the Kansas Department of Education's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Bullying. You mentioned the state law that went into effect, I guess, more than a decade ago, Rick. Yeah. What does the law do? Tell us a little more about that, and how severe are the penalties?
Yeah, I don't know if there's penalties. I mean, the law required each of the districts to have the law set out a definition and required. I don't have the law in front of me, but I'm going from memory here. But the law required that each district come up with a plan for how to address that. There was the requirement of the filing, I believe, of a plan. And I think districts took this seriously, but I think the role of the panel here is to try to gather resources together to be a support for districts as they're trying to address this problem. We're in a space where, in all candor, there's a lot of research, but not a lot of hard science that says this will work and eradicate it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of trial and error that's required. There's some promising things that are emerging out there, but I think the law was a really good first start, and it was a recognition by the legislature that this is something that school districts need to take seriously? I think they do. I think they do it in a variety of different ways. And I think the state board said, you know what, we can provide some more help here. Mm-hmm. And let's get a commission together. This commission includes, you mentioned educators, we have teachers, we have school leaders, we have psychologists, we have researchers, we have legislators, we have State Board of Education members. We are holding townhouses, open houses all over the state. We've already been to Clearwater, south of Wichita, and Garden City and Salina. We're coming to Girard. We'll be back in Wichita. We'll be in Lawrence. So we're doing what we can to gather input. We're trying to find ways to give students a voice so we can hear from them. So what we're going to try to do is come up with a series of recommendations of here's the kinds of things you want to think about, and here's the kinds of ways you can approach it. Here's some promising practices, and let's move together as a community, tying this to the Kansas Can initiative.
Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888 as we talk about school bullying across the state of Kansas. Becca from Kansas City, Missouri. Becca, you're on the air. Good morning.
Sure. So I work for MOXA, the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, and I help implement the Green Dot program in a couple of Shawnee Mission middle schools, so on the Kansas side. And a lot of what we're trying to teach kids is that there's things that they can do to step in and help others, because I think a lot of the time, too, we're asking students to tell teachers, and just as you were saying, they don't tell teachers and parents a lot of things that are happening, so we want to empower kids to think about small ways that they can help.
How are you doing that, Becca?
Sure. So we do, our program is Green Dot. So the DOT stands for do something directly, like saying, knock that off, I don't think that's funny, or checking in and saying, are you doing okay? If they see someone who's been hurt, others can help. They always suggest telling a teacher, and then I ask them to raise their hand if they would tell a teacher, and no one raises their hand. So we talk about, could you have an outgoing friend say something? Could you say something in a group? And then the third option, talk about something else. So creating a distraction. So if somebody is trying to share somebody's secret or spreading a rumor or making fun of someone, asking them about the weather or homework or what they're doing after school or a funny video that they saw. So just really trying to empower students to think about that this is their school, and there's a lot of things that teachers and parents would want them to do if we could make them, but they have to be the ones to decide to make that change.
Yeah, Becca, I appreciate the phone call. And Rick, I gather that getting groups like MOCASA to move in and help certainly would be a welcome in the state of Kansas.
Yeah, I would urge Becca to go to the KSDE, Kansas State Department of Education website. There's a bullying website there to share some information. And we are that's a part of what we're doing around the state. We're asking groups to come in and share information like this with us about promising practices. And what Becca taps into is a major part of any way to address the problem. And it's engaging the whole community. Kids know what's going on, and we've got to get the kids engaged in working together and feeling the comfort in talking about things. And it's just like in a family, when you have a toxic culture in a family, you see bad behavior and you enable it by not saying anything.
Right.
And that's what's happening, I think, a lot in our schools. And kids are getting pretty savvy. I mean, look what happened down in Parkland. And so I do think when you talk about you, Steve, you had that pessimistic note at the outset. I think we can take advantage of this generation's desire to be involved and engaged in their lives, whether it be through social media or not. And Becca's program is just, I think, although I don't know the specifics, sounds like a wonderful example of the kinds of things that we need to have school districts thinking about. And Becca, thank you for your work that you're doing in some of the school districts in Johnson County.
That's MOCSA, the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Abuse, I believe, that Becca represents there. You know, what you hear, Rick, from critics is that anti-bullying efforts are applied pretty unevenly across the state of Kansas. I mean, some districts are doing a lot, others not so much, and there's said to be little correlation between the size of the district and the anti-bullying efforts that any one district is undertaking. I mean, why is that? Why are you seeing these efforts applied so unevenly across the state?
Well, I think it's probably a fair criticism. It would be a fair criticism in every state. It would be a fair criticism of probably anything any community is mm-hmm. doing versus another community. So I wouldn't single out bullying here about this. I mean, every community has a different culture. And the schools within the communities have a different culture. And what works in Johnson County, I can pretty much guarantee you, isn't going to work in Colby or Paola or Whitewater or wherever the community may be. So that, I would hope that all the districts are what we want is the districts taking it seriously at the same percent, mm-hmm. if you will, across the board. But we have to come up with local solutions which are localized problems. Where there are common things, that's where we got to share best practices. And our hope is that that's the kind of thing that this task force can provide to the state as we continue to move forward.
You know, one thing that struck me as interesting from looking at some of the presentations made to your group, I noticed that eighth grade appears to be the grade most prone to bullying. Any theories as to why that is?
I've ever been in a junior high school.
Once upon a time.
Okay,
I think I remember something about that.
Yeah, you do. It's a difficult set of years for adolescents. The kids are struggling with not just their cognitive development, their emotional development, and we always tease about raging hormones in those grades, and it's just a difficult time. For kids, but this is a complex problem. I mean, the kids from the LGBTQ community, for example, will be facing different problems than others might. Students of race, students of color, students with disabilities, women will face different issues than men. And mm-hmm. but it is certainly clear that at that stage is where we get the highest reports of. Difficulty. And you asked the question, I'll answer. And I think it has to do with the developmental stage that the kids are at.
Right. I also was struck again by going through some of the slides that you all have been presented with here in recent months. You get a sense that there's two sort of self-contained areas that are really prone to bullying. And I'm thinking about the playground and the school bus, Rick. And if you could deal with bullying in those two places, you wouldn't solve the problem, but you'd go a long way towards dealing with it because, right. again, surveys show those are the two main times and areas where bullying occurs.
There is some evidence that the places where there's the weakest amount of direct supervision and there's a lot of common spaces. You probably would add the lunchroom to that and,
sure.
and some others. That's that. There is certainly evidence that that's where you get higher levels of bullying, and there's some evidence that addressing that does decrease the amount of bullying. That doesn't wipe out what is the fastest growing part of the bullying pie, if you will, and that's the cyberbullying space.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. that I think that you've identified something that we've talked about, and we understand. We just had a presentation at our last meeting by Dr. Paula Feita, a clinical child psychologist here at KU who studies this kind of thing. And a part of what the research shows is exactly what you're showing. But again, it's as we started at the outset, this is becoming more and more complex. So mm-hmm. that while we need to address that, and perhaps even as a starting point, I don't know that, that's not going to solve the problem.
Who gets bullied the most, Rick, girls or boys?
I can't give you a direct answer, but I think it probably is on the female side, but I don't know that.
Yeah. What do you ultimately hope the task force comes up with here as we begin to wind up?
We're going to come up with a series. There's no silver bullets here. Mm-hmm. And school districts, like a lot of things, want to pick up on the most recent fad and try that, and it doesn't work, then we try something else. And so I hope we can present a series of recommendations for here's some things that have been shown to work. Trial and error is going to be important here. You got to be flexible in dealing with it. We hope we can provide some insights as to how things can be implemented. So they work. Teachers have an awful lot on the plate. How many commissions are there that have gone on in the last couple of years dealing with a variety of the issues that teachers have to deal with?
Right.
So That kind of support, perhaps the task force work will continue, that we can do this, that we need better data collection, we need better data reporting, we need clarity in definition and in terms. You know, a lot of things get reported as bullying that probably is just bad behavior. It's not bullying. We need to get that clarified, what is and what isn't. So those are the kinds of things we've been talking about. We're nowhere close coming up with our conclusions or recommendations, but that's my hope for it, those kinds of things.
I gather teachers undergo training to be aware of and, you know how to recognize this problem.
Probably not as good as it should be, but I think they do. All the schools of education, I'm a dean, so I'm aware of this, that we certainly do address this in a small part, but this is there's a list of a lot of stuff that has to be covered. So a lot of this you learn on the fly, like you would in any job. However you were trained to do what you're doing, I dare say you learned a lot of it after you left school and started
right.
your job.
Right. Okay, that's Rick Ginsberg again, co-chair of the Kansas Department of Education's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Bullying. He's also dean of the University of Kansas Department of Education. He joined us this morning from the studios of KPR, that's Kansas Public Radio. Rick, sure appreciate the insights. Thanks for your time today.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk about how women can have their voices heard in this loud right versus left society we're living in these days. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can find me on the radio, on social media, and now I can be in your inbox. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to my weekly newsletter. It includes words by yours truly and arrives every Monday. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, roles written for people of color aren't always cast that way. How criticism over a white actor being originally cast for a Latina role spurred one Kansas City Theater to invite the stage community to a dialogue about inclusion in their ranks. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, you still hear the complaint that men's voices are louder than women's, and that's why they get heard more. Truth was, when Trish Hall ran the op-ed page for the New York Times, she found that submissions from men vastly outnumbered those from women. That suggests that women can be more hesitant to speak up in this crazy left versus right world we live in these days. So how can women find their voices, and what can they, and men for that matter, do to break through the clutter and get their views heard? Trish Hall is the author of a new book, Writing to Persuade, and she'll be speaking tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. Trish, it's nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
She's joined by Mary Sanchez, who's a columnist and a former member of the Kansas City Star's editorial board, where she was one of my colleagues. Mary, nice to see you again. Welcome back.
Nice to see you, Steve.
Trish, what is an op-ed? I mean, there's a history to this phrase that, frankly, I didn't know about until I looked at your book last night. Tell us about it.
Well, it's interesting. The Times started the op-ed page.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
I think in the early 70s, I should know the date, maybe 71, somewhere around there. And what it stood for was opposite the editorial page. So the idea was that you would offer an opportunity for people who were not part of the institution to present their ideas. And generally, people who have run op-ed interpret it to mean you should offer ideas that are different from what the editorials have. Mm-hmm. So the Times editorial page is very liberal, Democrat, sort of centrist Democrat. So we mostly looked for things that were more to the left or more to the right, but just different from that.
I would gather, Mary Sanchez, that idea of what the op-ed page is sort of evolved over time. It's not quite what Trish describes what it was back in 1971.
Absolutely. It has with people's expectations, with the internet in particular, their ability to go out and find their own voices. Cable news has dramatically changed the news business. There are a lot of different factors. And frankly, we were speaking earlier as we were waiting to come on with you. You know, the presidency right now has shifted things as well. And where the country is, just more fractured.
Yeah.
And very extreme.
Trish, I was really struck by your comment that the number of submissions from women, the number from men vastly outnumbered them. When you were seeing the op-ed page, To what extent? Would you have any numbers or any rough idea?
My sense at the time, it was hard to measure them, was, you know, men were 75-80% of the submissions.
Is that right?
People have done studies on that because there have been a lot of complaints that, you know, op-ed editors are discriminating against women. There was recently a study of op-eds by women on foreign policy and sort of national security kinds of issues. And they studied it over four separate points in time, and it's improved, but it's still something like 75% men, 25% women.
Those numbers just floor me, Mary. I mean, I you know, having worked down there, I'm surprised to hear it's 3-1. I didn't think it was such a big difference there.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Really?
I mean, even
yeah.
years ago when I wrote Race for the Kansas City Star, I ended up kind of inadvertently being part of the like point person that people would come to find diverse voices for their stories, because there were points, you know, where the Star was very dedicated to trying to reach broader audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were counting in stories, who were your diverse voices?
Mm-hmm.
Who did you go to? How many men did you quote?
Right.
And people, like goes to like. People will tend to go to who they feel comfortable with, who
yeah.
they have a history with. And that tends to be someone who's an awful lot like you.
You know, I exchanged emails with Derek Donovan yesterday just to ask him. He's the oversees the op-ed page for The Star, just to ask him if men are still outnumbering women. And he wrote back right away saying, oh, yeah, so things really haven't. Well, what do you make of that, Trisha? But what's the takeaway from that?
I mean, there are a lot of possible takeaways. One of mine is that if it's one thing if you're on Twitter or Facebook or you have direct access to some kind of audience, right? But if you're writing an op-ed, it's going to be screened, it's going to go to an editor, it's going to be edited, and the odds of being published in most places are not high. I mean, it's tougher in some places.
Because you get so many submissions.
But most yeah. places get a lot of submissions because there's a lot of people who want to get their point across. So it's a lot of work. You have no confidence or certainty that it'll be published. And sometimes I think that women don't do it just because it's a lot of time, and they have jobs, and they have kids, and they have lives. But
men do, too. All those things apply.
They do, but I think there are more men who work, say, on think tanks and the kind of institutions, academics, the institutions that exist in order to sort of produce intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more part of their jobs. So women in those environments also pitch op-eds, but I think outside of those environments, it's it just takes a lot of effort. And I think, I mean, there's a lot of dispute, and I know if I say this now, people will disagree with me right away, the question of whether women don't have the confidence of their opinions.
Well, that's what I was wondering about.
There are people who say, that's ridiculous. It's just that it's an old boys network and all these institutions keeping out women. It's hard to generalize from yourself, but as we were talking about a little bit earlier, I'm not that opinionated. I don't really understand what makes someone have the dedication and take the time that it requires to do that. Are women less likely to feel their opinions matter? Some of them, probably.
Right.
Does that explain the whole thing? I doubt it. I think it's probably a lot of different things. It's that they don't have the time. Maybe the biggest thing is, to do a good opinion piece, you have to know what you know, and you have to believe that's something worth sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to like look at what your expertise is and say, I know this and I have the right to say it. So I'm not sure that it's lack of confidence in their opinion so much as not actually understanding that they have some kind of experience that makes them an expert in something.
Mary, what's your take on this?
That's absolutely true. I would totally agree with everything that you said. I used to run the As I See It's, which are the Kansas City Star's guest opinion pieces.
Right.
This is when Miriam Pepper was the head of the editorial board before the current iteration.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have the same thing, you know, far more submissions by men. And oftentimes...
But this is 2019. Aren't things evolving? Aren't things changing? I mean...
I think they are somewhat...
I would hope so.
You hope so, and I think it's a continuous process, but... I think with anyone, any gender, you have to tell people, yes, you do have something to say. Oftentimes, they don't know quite how to hone in on it. They don't know how much they actually know about their own experiences. And they don't know what is news.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They don't know how to form their opinion in a cohesive way in, what, 650 words to put it across.
Yeah.
They'll tend to add in what they think the news editor is going to want, the opinion editor.
Yeah, I'm sort of struck by the fact that when you and I were writing editorials for the paper, the team, at least early on, was comprised of 3 women and 2 men. It was flipped the other way, at least slightly, and that was, you know, I thought that was interesting at the time. I was glad for it.
Yeah, that can be. You know, different dynamics, I think that plays in as well. People's backgrounds. You want a strong opinion page, I think, or a strong editorial board definitely has a wide diversity of people in every way, shape, and form that you can cut it. Their experiences, even of how they came to that position, are very important because that's how it frames how you think.
Right.
It frames how you form your opinion.
Yeah. We're talking about how to get your voices heard through op-eds in newspapers and how to get your voices heard in general. We're visiting with Trish Hall. She's the author of a new book, Writing to Persuade. She'll be speaking tonight at the Kansas City Public Library, 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the library. More information about that at kclibrary.org. She's joined by Mary Sanchez, who's a columnist and a former writer for The Star. Trisha, what struck me about your experience in gaining the op-ed job, and you mentioned this already here, is that you never considered yourself to be an especially opinionated person. And when I joined the Star's editorial board, what concerned me a lot was I didn't consider myself an especially opinionated person. Given that, why on earth did you want the job? And I could ask myself the same question, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good question. I had started in college as a news writer, and I went to Berkeley and I covered riots, and I was like a total news person.
Right.
In my 30s at the Wall Street Journal, I started writing page one stories at the Journal or like feature stories or like magazine stories. So it shifted the way I reported and wrote. So when I went to the Times, I went there as a food writer. I was in the feature sections, and I wrote about all different kinds of things, but what you might generally call lifestyle. And I became my real skill, and my favorite thing was to create and recreate weekly sections, which were more of a thing than they are now. And so I wanted the opinion job because they were getting the resources and the opportunity to create a new weekly section. And that's what I love to do.
Yeah.
And so the sort of daily op-eds where people, a lot of them seemed sort of boring to me, where they talked about fairly narrow things. I actually grew to appreciate those, and they reminded me more of college. It's a different way of thinking, obviously, as you know, than a news story. It's like an analysis with an opinion and dissecting things. So it was interesting learning about that, but my real motivation was to create a serious and fun section for men and women that didn't have that weird gender thing that a lot of the lifestyle stuff had. I also had been the editor of the Sunday business section, so I, you know, and most of the readers were male, and I liked the idea of reaching everyone.
Right.
I think because I came out of feature sections, I like a big range of topics. And so one of the things I tell people when they're trying to figure out how to get their voice heard, besides sort of understanding what they know, they have to have some sense of what an editor likes and doesn't like. And, you know, I liked very human, very specific stories. So when we were talking about what people know, one of the writers that we had contributing fairly often was a landlord in Cleveland. And I like those kinds of things because people get very stuck in their own little world. And even though it's opinion, it's a way to bring people an experience of another world.
Right, right.
So I had a lot of that kind of stuff because of my features background.
Mary, how tough was it for you? Once upon a time, you were a reporter.
Absolutely.
I remember those days.
I still think of myself as a reporter.
Do you?
Yes.
How tough was it, you know, moving into more of an opinionated kind of role?
Personally, I think it was. I mean, editors can even tell you that because I still struggle a bit with wanting to at least know both sides of something. I don't feel like my opinion is valid unless I have looked at both sides. And it's also part of the persuasive argument. You know, like I'm dancing right now around, I probably need to write a whole column about the term open borders, mm-hmm. because it is everywhere. I cover immigration as well. And I find myself basically writing this same column over and over when I'm replying to people who email me yeah. and argue with me about some of my opinions about what should be happening at our southern border. But the terminology is so caught up right now.
Well, you know, I used to feel exactly the same way. I wanted to know both sides, even as an opinion writer. Is that an attitude that maybe is more, I'm really reaching here, is more common among women than it would be among men? And maybe that's what holds women back more? Women maybe a little more even-handed in some broad sense? I'm stereotyping horribly here, I know, but...
Well, we may sometimes, this is a generalization, some women, there are definitely women who function stereotypically as men, you know, who show up in a room and by God, they're going to tell you what they think
they
and
the
they're really not going to be listening very much. Mm-hmm. Women do tend to have a call and response sort of way that they converse.
Yeah.
And that inherently builds in a listening factor.
I actually think that would make them, if they would do it, it makes them good opinion writers.
Absolutely.
Because when you know both sides, or there's always more than two sides, right? But if you're listening and you understand a lot of different people's feelings and what's going on, you write much more persuasively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the least persuasive things are the ones that are just, I think this and this is true.
Right.
And then you're like, well, what about this and what about that? If they don't have some understanding of different points of view, I think they're much weaker pieces. So I think that's a really it is hard to generalize about women because I know women who talk incessantly and women who don't talk at all.
Right.
So how do you account for all those differences? I mean, I think you have to say that they're all different. But if they do tend to have the ability to listen, that's actually a great quality and good journalism, I think, of any kind.
It's hands down. It is the number one quality, is being able to listen and really listen, deeply listen, not just hear the facts that already resonate with you. I mean, some of this gets into almost even brain science of how stereotypes are formed and how people, your brain, literally how it catalogs information. And I think being aware of that can make someone a better reporter and certainly a better opinion columnist, because otherwise you're just going to write to what you already mm-hmm. think, or you're going to preach to the choir, is what I always said. And if you really want to persuade people, if you really want to move them a little bit, you have to be pretty believing that and how hard a struggle that's going to be. You can't think you're just going to overwhelm everyone and by God, suddenly they're going to come over to your side or something.
Right.
That doesn't happen. The best compliment that I hear is when people say, you know what, I often disagree with you, but you always make me think.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Right, right.
That's real.
Yeah, I totally get that. You know, one of your points in the book, Trish, and when it comes to learning to be effective at persuading others, is just what Mary was saying. Respect your audience. Learn to be empathetic. And I'm wondering, why is empathy important in the persuasion game?
Because empathy really means that you have some sort of sense of what they're experiencing and how they're living their life and how they see things. It doesn't mean necessarily you're sympathetic to them or you agree with them, but you get them. And
they have to recognize that to make yourself, your point of view, come across more effectively.
Well, partly that, but partly also this is, again, sort of how the brain works, that all the research shows that we're really persuaded by people who are similar to us and people who connect with us. You're not persuaded by people who yell at you or sort of your enemy. So although there's a lot of yelling going on right now in the political discourse, that's not really about persuasion. It's about kind of rounding up your team.
Mm-hmm.
If you're actually trying to convince someone that they might want to look at something this way, you need to be sort of on the same team. You need to make it clear that you connect to them and you get it. And I mean, I would love to read your open borders column because I don't know what that word means. I don't understand what's going on. It's the same as Medicare for All. There's a lot of words out there that don't actually, they're not very clear. And I think that there's a lot of stridency, but if you actually look at polls of how people think, there is actually a lot of agreement in this country on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, so how do you, you probably do agree with a lot of your readers in ways they may not even be aware of. And I think it sounds like you know exactly how to reach them, and you don't reach them without showing some kind of understanding of that, what you have in common, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. Or basic respect. I mean, any programming, and I've done some of these that try and educate people on differences and then coalesce them around common causes.
Mm-hmm.
It all starts with helping people understand why, who they are, how they form their own opinions, what's their own background. And oftentimes people aren't really consciously aware of it. And then you can move to that center portion, or that one thing that everyone can kind of go, wow, I kind of felt that too at one point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a place to start. And if you think about that, even within writing, it allows respect to come in. It negates the name calling.
Yeah.
And it surrounds you with a purpose of trying to inform.
So, Mary, when Trish advises that writers shouldn't get into fights, you know, she writes, don't say things like, you're wrong, or I'm right and you know it. That resonates with you.
Absolutely. Well, that's a conversation ender.
Yeah.
You know, that's screaming, that's
pontificating. But there's a lot of that going, a lot of conversation enders going on these days.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I find it very frustrating. It really is. You know, I will say one thing, too, that as much as we talk about, you know, needing to write what you know and writing from personal background, if you're a person of color, it can backfire.
Hmm.
There are so many times when if I write on an issue of immigration, my last name, or the fact of perhaps even somebody knows that my father came from Mexico City, it's an immediate shutoff for some people.
Because?
Because they assume that I'm already too in
invested.
That camp.
Yeah.
And so no matter what I write and how factual, this is to her point in the book about facts don't really persuade people, you have to be careful with it. And I'm very careful with how often I write about the personal, because if my real goal is to help inform, I have to be aware that for part of my audience, that's not going to get me there.
Mm-hmm. This was really interesting to me, Trish. You advise that another rule of persuasion is play on feelings. And you say feelings are more important than facts.
I know that killed me. I'm sure you feel the same way as a reporter, but I mean, I love facts. I'm like that nerdy child who liked to read the encyclopedia.
In theory, facts are important.
I love them.
Yeah.
And I think that they do influence people. And as I write in the book, if you get them wrong, you really turn people off. Because if they know you're wrong and your facts are wrong, they won't listen to you. But you can't actually win them over with a bunch of facts. Like, I mean, immigration is a really interesting example.
Yeah,
there's facts, and then there's how people feel about the country. I was in Washington recently, and I had a cab driver who had come here years ago from Ethiopia, and he was against more immigration because he thought we had enough people, and maybe in Washington we do. I don't know. But it's difficult to talk to people without understanding why they feel a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of saying, well, immigrants are not more likely to be criminals and they're not more likely to be on welfare or whatever it is people care about. It doesn't always get there by itself.
Right. You know, Mary, you mentioned this earlier here that a lot of writers have trouble getting to the point. What would you advise, you know, when you sit down to write a piece of persuasion? What, you know, how do you sort of negotiate in your own mind, you know, what the point of your piece is and how early in the piece you're going to make that point? And there are all those considerations that go into these things.
Outline it and speak to two people about it. One who knows you very well and one who doesn't know you at all.
Hmm.
And try and tell them about what you want to write. And then listen to their feedback. You may not have the time to do this. Play it out in your own head.
But in the course of talking to them, you're sort of forming the structure of your piece in your mind. Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. You'll figure out what resonated with them and what didn't. You'll force yourself to say your point more explicitly and more to the point.
Yeah.
And then you can figure out what arguments help you make that point and which are kind of tangents that you don't need.
Yeah. You know, I was struck, Trish, in your book, you talk about getting these op-eds from really well-known people, highly educated people, and they couldn't write a lick. I mean, you really had a struggle with basic syntax and structure and grammatical issues. You were a little surprised by that, at least early on.
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem that people have, if they're really expert in their field and if they're well-known, it might even make it more complicated, is that they write in the language of their field and they use that jargon and they don't actually know how to talk like normal people anymore.
Jargon's a column killer, you're saying.
Yeah, and so they don't, and they wind up to things. And if they're academics, we had a lot of great contributors from various universities, but if they're in the academic field, there is a structure to their writing that is very different and it can take a long time to get to the point. And you can't do that in a column. You don't have time to do that. And you'll lose people. Like, we all know that people, they're not giving you a lot of time. They might give you two sentences.
You got to get there fast or you're going to lose them really quickly. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Trish Hall, author of a new book, Writing to Persuade. She speaks at 6:30 this evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information at kclibrary.org. Mary Sanchez joined us as well. She's a columnist for the Tribune Content Agency, and you can find her stuff on their website. You can also follow her on Twitter at msanchezcolumn on Twitter. Thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Tomorrow on the show, a lack of diversity in casting sparked controversy recently for one Kansas City theater. Now another is exploring how to make the local theater scene more inclusive. We'll find out how. You can find and follow us on Twitter as well. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.